This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers and negotiating those difficult moments on the way. I'm Giles Prey-Phillips and with me is Jim Daly.
Oh, I like that. Straight to it. Straight into it.
Hello. Jimmy. just straight into like serious stuff because we've got quite a serious pod today.
We've got a very serious pod and we should say as well, we are back after a break last week for another serious subject because it was the week of the Queen's funeral. So we felt like it would be the right thing to do to take a week off. A lot of pods taking weeks off. So we thought we would have a break so that people can get through that day however they wanted to, I guess, as respectfully as possible. So that's why we're back there. So yeah, if we start with the serious subject there and then obviously this week's episode, some very serious subjects as well, but very enjoyable at the same time.
Oh, it's fascinating. I don't think I've written as many notes before the pod or during the pod as with this week's guest, who is the amazing Andrew Bustamante, who is a former CIA intelligence officer. So a little bit different to what we normally do. But as we said a few weeks back, we're looking to talk to some interesting people in other industries. And obviously, Andrew's got an incredible story and you know, we talk about his recruitment process, his background in the armed forces in the US, and then all manner of questions that we had about being a CIA intelligence agent. And it was just so fascinating.
He's one of the most interesting people I've ever met in my entire life, I think, but also is really has his own business now, Everyday Spy, and has a podcast and very good at sort of like talking about it as well. So he, you know, very graciously answered a lot of our very sort of like entry-level questions about being a spy. And but there's some really, really good bits in there about sort of like coping with the you know, the extreme stresses of the situation and the egos of some of the spies and all sorts of things that go with it. You know, you watch these, we ask him about kind of like spy movies and how true they are and stuff, but you watch those kind of movies and actually it doesn't even really scratch the surface of what it's like to be a spy. But fascinating individual, and you know, he had to sort of pop off early, but like we could have chatted to him for hours, and maybe he'll come on one day again and answer the rest of our questions because he was just an absolute joy to talk to. A fascinating life.
Yeah, really, really interesting, the whole thing. And like you say, you kind of think of spies, you think of James Bond or Mission Impossible, and they just seem ludicrous when you actually talk to someone who's actually worked for a serious spy. And just, yeah, you know, thinking that James Bond is actually properly shit, isn't he? As a
yeah. As a we didn't get to ask him about what he thought about. Like he gives during the episode a few series that he thinks are movies that he thinks are like truest to form. So listen to those if you are like a fan of that genre, to which are like closest to what it is actually like. But we didn't actually get to ask him about James Bond, but yeah, I'm sure he would have said that James Bond is terrible. An awful spy. Well, it just tells everyone his name and where he is and favorite drink. And,
you know what drink he drinks, you know what kind of, you know he's got a PP-44, whatever it is, his PP, whatever his gun is. I don't know, I can't remember what it is. Walter PPK or something, isn't it? You just know everything about him. He's just, I mean, it's classic kind of British dandy flop, isn't he?
there's an interesting bit from Andrew about like the difference between US clandestine services and the British as well, and MI6 and stuff. And actually, stuff I didn't know about at all, really. And why would I? But it's really, really fascinating and just great guest. So, and as you said, we're trying some different things this series, I guess. We're technically on one long rolling series, but since coming back from our break, we're trying a few sort of different things, and this is definitely one of them. So we hope our listeners appreciate it and enjoy this episode because it's a good one.
Yeah, like you said, we could have talked to Andrew for a long time, and like you said, maybe we'll get him back on to answer some of our other questions, because I had shitloads of other questions I wanted to ask him. So hopefully we can persuade him to come and talk to us again. But yeah, it was great to talk to him, and appreciate him being on the podcast.
And there's a little bit extra from him as well for our patrons, as there is every episode at patreon.com, patreon.com/blankpodcast. So if you want to hear a bit more from Andrew, then do sign up to our Patreon. There's only one level. It's £4 a month, and you get extra content. You get the episode advert free, and you get it 24 hours early as well. So
yeah, you get it early.
Yeah.
You get to hear it before the rest of the world gets to hear it. I mean, what more could you want?
Yeah, get it exclusive, basically, for 24 hours. So. But what a 24 hours.
Exactly.
So yeah, please do sign up if you want to hear more from Andrew and for all our guests as well. Shall we crack on with the episode? Shall we get into it?
Yeah, I think so, because we haven't had any correspondence this week.
No, we were going to do a shout out, like our Twitter feed's gone a bit quiet. So do you know, if you're enjoying the episode, maybe no one's enjoying them. If you're enjoying the pod and
if you're not enjoying it, just let us know. You know, we'll try and make it better.
It. Yeah, exactly. We'll take constructive criticism. You know, if any bits that jump out at you, maybe going through the old episodes, you know, maybe you're going through the first handful, anything that jumps out of you or anything you enjoyed, please do let us know. And we might read it out in the future as well. So there's a little incentive.
We'd love to read it out.
We'd love to, actually.
We'd actually love some content to read out,
So we're on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook, and our handle for all three is...
@blankpod. And just to say that, you know, we do really, really appreciate any messages, because Jim and I are suckers for validation.
Completely. You know, we don't quite have the ego of a CIA spy.
No.
But we've still got pretty big egos.
We've got egos. We've got the egos of two amateur podcasters.
AKA rubbish spies.
We're professional. We're professional podcasters, aren't we? Because...
We're probably professional podcasters.
Yeah, I think we can say rubbish spies. Yeah, rubbish spies. Yeah, definitely not.
Exactly. Spies. But speaking of a very good
spy. What a good cover.
Well, quite. I mean, maybe I'm not. Maybe I am a spy. You know, but
you
I wouldn't
fit
tell
the profile
you.
of a spy in England, basically.
Boring. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which Andrew does reveal later on. Yeah. So maybe I am a spy. Yeah, maybe it has been hiding in plain sight. Maybe that's the best way to be. Mm. So, what secrets would we get from the podcast? Actually, a lot of secrets.
Down at Chesham United on a Saturday.
Exactly. A lot of interesting people go down there. So, including a former podcast guest. Although he wasn't there on Thursday. But anyway, I think we'll crack on with this week's episode.
Talking shit long enough.
quick edit here for editing. I need to make sure that I say Andrew's name right. Hang on, give me 2 seconds.
Bustamante.
Mm-hmm. Cool. This is the fascinating, the wonderful, the lovely Andrew Bustamante on the Blank Podcast.
Wrong music. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for being with us. We really do appreciate your time coming on to talk to us. And I guess that's kind of where I want to start is this sort of concept of that you talk about what you've been through, your experiences working with the CIA. And I wondered what kind of led you to that. What led you to being so candid about your experiences and wanting to talk to various people about what you've done?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's not a question that I get very often, to be honest. I think a big part of what drove me to have this open conversation about my time at CIA and an open conversation about CIA in general is that there's so much that people don't share about the agency, and I don't know why they don't share it. Because when I left, they were very express about what we could and couldn't talk about. And what we couldn't talk about is a very small fraction of the work that we actually do there. So coming out of those doors, walking across that marble seal to leave, you know, I was left with this open question, like, why hasn't anyone shared the good news story? Why hasn't anyone shared the everyday life story? Why hasn't anyone shared, you know, the journey? All we do is we put this unnecessary secret around this mystery that isn't actually helpful or healthy. So, you know, I kind of endeavored from that point on to say, well, I'm going to be very open in my personal life talking about CIA. And then that just developed into a business.
Is there a fear from like previous people that have worked there that if I say, I mean, I know there is stuff you can and can't, but even the stuff you can, the slight fear that if I say stuff, I might expose stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say there's kind of two or three different fears, right? The first round of fear is based in culture. So we're a secret culture. I mean, I come from something, a unit that was called the National Clandestine Service. So yeah. Clandestine is at the core of that. So culturally, we're a very secretive bunch. Even when we go out and we hang out together, we still lie to each other. We still keep secrets from each other. So culturally, it's hard to break that history of secrets. And then there was a really big break in our culture in 2001, in September of 2001, when 9/11 happened, and we realized how our culture of secrecy had essentially left the United States vulnerable to this attack over 9/11. And then Congress came in and forced this massive change in how the intelligence community worked. So you have this old guard of pre-9/11 people who were, you know, a small group of very, like, you know, very much a good old boys club, very, very secretive, very, you know, closed. And then this giant surge of new hiring post 9/11, which is, you know, also a big break in terms of culture, generational cultures with millennials and with, you know, Gen Yers and whatever else. But then post 9/11, we come in. I was a post 9/11 person. We're trained right out of the gates in share, communicate, over communicate, right? Completely countercultural to the old heads who are now in charge of CIA. Mm. So there's these two cultures trying to merge, and it's not merging very well. You also have the bureaucratic process is a very slow process. So even though Congress had told CIA they had to change, that doesn't mean that CIA overnight is going to rewrite all of its policies. And it doesn't mean, and the government in general, the government doesn't adapt very quickly. So now I find myself leaving CIA in 2014. look at the world in 2014, and you have podcasts, you have YouTube, you have Instagram, you have stories, you have Snapchat, you have, you know, a whole world of technology that allows people to talk. But CIA doesn't update their policies to tell their CIA officers how to use these platforms. So a little bit of what I'm doing is experimental, talking about it all. I do know that there are very real legal repercussions if I overstep my bounds. Mm-hmm. But I also recognize that there's a story about the men and women still living in that world of secrecy that is really very beneficial to not just the American people, but the entire worldwide public, because every country has a clandestine service, but not every country is allowed to talk about it. The UK is one of those fantastic examples where they denied it altogether until the 90s. And even now, MI6 officers don't retain rights to their own stories.
Wow. So we are very different than in this country. We're very British yeah. about it.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. In the United States, we can leave CIA and we can write books and we can make movies or we can do whatever we want to do with our story because we retain rights to copyright to our story. MI6 officers, the day they swear their allegiance or they swear their oath, they sign a piece of paper that says that MI6 owns their personal story rights. MI6 owns all book rights. MI6 owns all movie rights. Any money that person ever generates in the future, they're basically at MI6's discretion for how much they'll get paid.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. You guys are kind of ruthless. Yeah.
Again,
you're going to say that. Yeah. It's not history, so much fun being James Bond after all. Let's talk a bit about your journey because I know you grew up in a military family. It sort of seems like you were destined to join the military yourself. Is that fair to say?
You know, it's funny. I would say yes. It's a fair thing to say, even though every part of me did not want to join the military. Right? Like when you grow up in a military family, and for anybody out there who's grown up in a military family, they know what I'm talking about. It's like I don't want to do. I was doing the dishes at like 7 years old, as if I was working in boot camp, and it was miserable. So why would I voluntarily sign up for that after I turned 18? But it was all I had ever known. So there was a certain element of of the familiar and the routine was very comfortable. So when the time came to look for colleges, my parents didn't have any money saved up because their assumption was always I was going to go into the military. Mm. So my odds and my options were kind of limited. I didn't want to take on a bunch of debt. And then when I started looking at scholarships, a military college was the highest paying scholarship with the most long-term opportunity. And that's the direction I ended up going for very pragmatic reasons. As much as I would love to say that I was just a, you know, red-blooded patriot, it was really just I didn't want to take on a bunch of school debt.
Yeah, I think that's probably the process for a lot of people, actually, when it comes to those kind of choices in their life. That actually, it's, you know, not always following your heart or whatever, or dreams. It's unfortunately pragmatism sort of has to come into these things, doesn't it? Because a lot of us don't maybe have the options or the choices or the opportunities that maybe other people have. Sometimes you just have to kind of go where you can go.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really interesting because when I found myself taking that path, as we so often do, that's when I learned how terrible I was at being a soldier. It was funny. I was just talking to somebody recently, like my entire, in many ways, when I look at my journey, and I think it's probably the common for many of us, for successful people, especially, we look at our own life, our own journey, and all we see is how much we sucked along the way. I was a horrible student. I was a horrible soldier. I was a mediocre officer at CIA. Like I just, you know, there's so much I could have done better everywhere. And in the best effort of just trying to survive and best effort of just trying to hash together something that I enjoyed along the way, I realized I wasn't very good at anything, really.
So, and is that true? Or is that you being a harsh critic on yourself? Like if we asked to anyone you'd worked with, they would say, no, he was great.
Yeah, no, that's where the rub is, right? Because we're always our own harshest critic. So I'm certain, but I'm also the only person that has the complete point of view. I'm the one that knows how much energy I actually have. I'm the one that knows every time I cut a corner. I'm the one that knows every time I jump to a conclusion, every time I skip doing a little extra research. But it is encouraging to know that the people that I find myself surrounded by all the time are high achieving, high performing people that impress me. So that must mean that to other people, even if it's just a few, I must also appear as high performing, high achieving. So I'm finding myself in the right company. I might as well keep doing what I'm doing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you said you felt like it wasn't a particularly enjoyable time, maybe being in the military. Were there any aspects of it that you did enjoy though? Were there aspects of it that you flourished?
Yeah, so for sure. The military is where I discovered I had a language proficiency. Without having gone to the military academy, without having them told me, like they put me through a test and they said, hey, you should learn Chinese. You should learn Chinese or Japanese or Arabic or Korean. And when they gave me those four options, because the military is so generous, 166 languages, and they gave me four. So that was how I ended up, you know, signing up for Chinese. And then I found out that I was pretty good at Chinese, and I would have never known that otherwise. And that was a really amazing opportunity to learn the language, to travel through the country, to build friendships with other Chinese speakers, not just in my university, but in universities across the country, which in 2002, there weren't many Chinese speaking universities or Chinese language courses. So that was one thing that I would have never discovered. I also would have never discovered my own athletic ability had the military not forced me into a regimented, you know, physical training routine with a very closely monitored process for tracking our progress and our growth. So they knew when to turn up the dial, and they took care of your dietary needs. They took care of your coaching needs. And, you know, before I knew it, I was a better athlete than I would have ever been. I had a language I would have never had. I was learning how to fly. I realized, you know, I had learned how to fly, how to parachute, how to glide, all these things that, you know, a rural Pennsylvania boy isn't going to learn how to do these things unless, you know, Uncle Sam basically pays the bill. Mm. So it was really a fascinating thing to discover what I enjoyed and what I was good at in a world that, you know, I would have never had access to had I stayed, you know, back at home.
Yeah, and I wonder, does that sort of like thirst for, I guess, personal improvement and learning new things, does that continue to this day? Do you find yourself still desperate to learn new stuff, skills and languages and stuff that was maybe bred while you were in the military.
Yeah, absolutely. What I found is that it doesn't take much. It's like a mosquito bite. Experience is like a mosquito bite. You know, you get a bug bite if you're allergic to mosquitoes like I am, and that bite, that itch is just incessant. You'll scratch your own skin off trying to scratch that itch. And that's exactly what happened to me. Once the military got a hold of me and took me out of Pennsylvania, and then they started teaching me how to shoot and teaching me how to navigate across the land and how to do SEER school, and they put me in foreign countries, and all of a sudden, like, life became this adventure. It became this smorgasbord of experiences that I absolutely wanted to have. I didn't care if it was a pleasant experience or an unpleasant experience. I kept telling myself, like, who gets to do this? I remember being in SEER school, and I was in the survival part of SEER school, and we were up in the mountains in Colorado. It was the summer of 2000, and it was there was a forest fire raging not far from where our survival school was happening, and every day the instructors would get a briefing on whether or not they had to evacuate us from this forest fire. And even though there was a forest fire looming, there were standing puddles of water from ice melt and snow melt from the winter, because we're up in the mountains in Colorado. And so the bug activity was just miserable. So every morning we would basically crawl out of a tree trunk that we had been hiding in for survival simulation, right? Covered in ant bites and mosquito bites. And, you know, we would carry our grungy, dirty, tired asses over to this fire pit where we would get the morning briefing, and always hoping that the forest fire was going to cause an evacuation so that we could sleep in a hotel that night, something, right? And so miserable and so terrible, and you're eating like the weeds that you can find in the area around you. And still, you know, every day they'd come out and say, hey, there's no evacuation today. Training is on as scheduled. There was like this collective groan, but at the same time, we're like, there's 100 million people waking up to an alarm today, driving into an office to go, you know, slave their life away, typey typey. And I get to go, you know, just survive off the land and have this experience that nobody gets to have. So it's a very addictive thing to push yourself to find out how your brain and body can be optimized and how they work together in concert, and really understand kind of this amazing creation that is the world and life and the human body, the human experience.
That's fantastic. That's amazing. Now, when it comes to getting recruited to be in the CIA, how does that work? Now, I'm going to say this now, Andrew, that, you know, the two British guys here, we are going to probably, over the course of this podcast, ask you some very basic questions. So how does it work being recruited into the CIA?
Yeah, basic questions are my favorite kind, so I'm not worried about it at all.
Okay, good.
good. Are you in the right place?
There's no one way that CIA recruits. CIA recruits in multiple different ways. All of the intelligence services, all of the first world elite intelligence services, we all share recruiting tactics with one another.
Okay.
Like, wow, okay. As unromantic as it sounds, you know, there's every intelligence service is still a government organization. Every government organization still has a human resources HR component, and every HR component in every government office is essentially the same. You know, it's boring and painful and frustrating, and you've got to tie yourself to budgetary cycles, and you know, there's always the one boss that half the people hate and the other half suck up to. So that's just how it works. So in the HR world of secret intelligence recruiting, they have specific intelligence. They have a specific recruiting processes, strategies that they use. They know what kind of person they're looking for, what universities to search for. They know what GPAs and what specific degree categories they're looking for. But then they also know that not every potential candidate is going to come from that cookie cutter Ivy League background, that there's a lot of really good talent that's hiding in other places. So then they'll look in those, you know, off the beaten path kind of locations too, because they've got the numbers, they've got the math and the history to know that it's a statistically relevant group that they're hunting for. So they'll look in the private sector. They'll look for people in corporate Corporate positions like finance, corporate positions that have to do with accounting, forensic investigations, security operations, even the operational side of manufacturing, the operational side of sales. Like, there's a lot of the right skill sets naturally present in individuals that have those backgrounds. So when CIA or when MI6 or when Mossad or when, you know, DGSE, when any of them go to hire, yes, they're of course going to college fairs and they're taking resumes at college job fairs. Yes. And they're also going to large security conferences. So where security professionals gather because they want to become law enforcement officers or they want to, you know, work in the next big corporate security office, they'll have a stand, they'll have a place there for them as well. But of course, they're also very actively recruiting out of the military so that they can find former military intelligence officers, but also former military pilots, former military researchers, former military scientists. Any skill set that that speaks to the critical thinking, speaks to the operational prioritization, speaks to what we call ethic or moral flexibility, which is the ability to quickly adapt your willingness to commit things that other people might say are immoral or unethical. So for example, if you're a police officer, you might think that it's unheard of to shoot an elderly person. But as soon as that elderly person pulls a gun and points it at you, you will shoot that elderly person, right? The actual response time for a person who's willing to process through that cognitive dissonance, meaning they see an old person, they see a gun, the two things don't match up. Some people will freeze when they're given those two very dissociative inputs. Other people will prioritize one input over the other. If they're the person who prioritizes the gun ahead of the elderly person, then that's a good fit for CIA. If they're the kind of person that prioritizes the elderly person ahead of the gun, then maybe not such a good fit for elite service to your country. So they'll recruit in all those different fashions. I was kind of a mix of being recruited out of the military and also being picked up while I was in the application process to another government organization. So I was trying to leave the military and go into the Peace Corps, which is another federally funded organization. And in that process, I was intercepted by a recruiter and invited to come to Washington, D.C.
I was going to ask you about the actual process. So it actually sounds like quite a sort of straightforward recruitment process. You weren't given like a sort of empty briefcase and told to like meet under a tree in a certain location or something like that. It sounds like quite a sort of boring, straightforward HR kind of thing.
Exactly. And that's the thing that is, I wish that it was more sexy and exciting because it would make a better story. But in all honesty, if somebody were to show up at a restaurant, like if I were to be eating at a Chinese restaurant at 26 years old and they were to walk up with an empty briefcase and be like, "You've got to meet me at the tree around the corner at 10 p.m. All you have to do is say the mockingbird sings and I'll know it's you." I don't know that I would have gone to that tree. I don't know that I would have. I would have missed an entire career opportunity and not even known it.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Yeah.
Did it ever cross your mind, though, when you were in the military to... I know you obviously said you were looking to go into the Peace Corps. Had it ever crossed your mind about joining the CIA?
You know, it's funny. The answer is yes. So, I mean, I don't know what it's like for a little boy in the UK, or if you want to be, you know, if you want to be a part of the woke culture, a little person in the UK. But in the United States, you know, in the 1980s, every little boy wanted to be a police officer, a fireman, a spy, or a pilot. That was a fighter pilot. That's what we all wanted to be. So I was a 1980s little boy. So I grew up wanting all four of those things all the time. And for a long time, I thought I could be all four at the same time. But then when I got into the military academy, when I got into the Air Force Academy, I was very much on a track to be pilot. And that's where I really had to make a choice. You know, 21 years old with the right grades and the right physical aptitude to pick between military intelligence and being a pilot, like actual pilot training, I chose military intelligence and I put in my paperwork and I said, "Hey, this is what I want to be." And that's when I came face to face with government bureaucracy, because the government came back and said, "You're going to be a pilot. We appreciate that you would be interested in military intelligence, but there are better qualified people than you. And your background, your your experience with the Air Force Academy and your seat height and your vision and your blood pressure, they all show that you would be optimized as a military pilot. So that's what you're going to be. I figured when the military told me that there are better people qualified than me just in the military, that there was no reason for me to ever even pursue something like CIA. And then I was really surprised when I left the Air Force and the CIA tapped me on the shoulder, because I was like, hold on. There were better people than me just in the Air Force. You're saying that in the entire United States, I am like on the list of people to be considered? So it was a bit of a surprise, but it was a pleasant surprise.
It's almost quite romantic, actually, that come full circle. And actually, that wish had then presented itself. I have to say, growing up, I was born in 84, so I'm a late 80s kid. I wanted to be a footballer, which I think is a lot of British kids want to be a footballer. Footballer, a cartoonist, or a dinosaur. I'd say one of those.
Two of those is kind of possible.
yeah. But as we all know, footballer is very hard to get. So I have to sort of working for clandestine, you know, MI6, anything like that for us here. Just even if someone had told me at that age, you know, that this might happen, it feels like otherworldly. Like it feels like completely unsurmountable. I don't know if that's the same thing you felt, but like it feels like it's just not something. I'd say not even people like me, anybody gets into. Like I wouldn't even know where to start with that. So I don't know if it never even sort of crossed my mind.
Well, it's funny. The reason I think it crosses our mind in the U.S. is because there's a lot of spy fiction in the U.S. I mean, we have children's shows called Spy Kids. And it's not that we have any idea what spying is. We all think that it's gadgets and half-naked women and fast cars and, you know, people just throwing money at you. So you get to every undercover identity is a billionaire, an eccentric billionaire, like like something you see in the Marvel universe. So that's what we kind of expect it to be, and then it's of course nothing like that in real life, because if you're going to be undercover, if you're going to keep a secret, you have to be completely and totally uninteresting, not just unknown and undesirable, but completely and totally like boring, almost repulsive. Yeah. Because if you want to be forgotten, you have to be so non-alerting that people, even when they see you, they don't want to remember you. They want to fill their short-term memory with something other than your face and your smell and the things that you said. So it's an extremely different world than what you see in the movies. But that,
so at that point, you're like, oh, thanks.
Yeah, I was going to say, it slightly changes the headhunting kind of thing of it. Oh, really, guys? I mean,
yeah. So it's interesting because it is surreal when they tap you on the shoulder. It's absolutely surreal every step of the recruitment process. You go through these psychological batteries, and you get these questions, and you go through these role plays, and you're writing these reports that you're like, I can't believe I get to do this. And then at the same time, when the more that you train in the professional side of clandestine service, the more you realize, like, oh my gosh, I am basically pretending to be a low-level administrator in a company of people who hate me. And even if they did know who I was, even if I was real, there isn't a single cubicle in this entire office building who would want me to come knock on the door and say, you want to have lunch with me? Right? It's like it's the most alone experience that you can kind of imagine, because your true community is all hidden. You have hundreds of people supporting you and you know who they are, but they're all equally just as undesirable and ignored in their undercover positions as you are. So your entire network is this secret network of people that no one pays attention to.
So that, I guess, there's two emotions there. It must feel quite maybe lonely, I guess, in a way that you're putting yourself into these situations where you are kind of a loner, but at the same time quite exciting that you know it's part of something bigger and you've got all these secret things alongside you. But I guess maybe as a third question, you're trying to eradicate those feelings, because actually you are just trying to be almost like an actor, aren't you? Just play this boring role. So maybe you've got sort of conflicting emotions in there.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's funny that you bring up acting, because acting is one of those areas that that we discuss quite frequently on the inside, especially as we're learning how to live out our cover. So the closest comparison in the acting world is method acting, mm-hmm. Is that right? Yeah. I think it's method acting. Yeah. Where the actor becomes the character in their full-time life.
Yeah.
So that when the camera's on or when the camera's off, they're never outside of that mind space. That's the closest comparison we have, except that we are taught that we need to method act with a certain compartmentalization technique in our brain so that we can compartmentalize the fact that we know who we really are and that we're really there to collect sensitive secrets. So then we can still play the role 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But whenever we don't ever lose sight of the fact that we are there to collect a very specific piece of information against a specific objective. So we're always driving the character. We're always driving the character to pursue a specific outcome. Whereas a method actor is generally just a character reacting to their environment. So it's two very different approaches, but we don't get the luxury of then, you know, going insane and doing drugs and making back payments off of the success of our movies. We just get played a flat government rate.
Exactly. I wonder if actually maybe a lot of sort of CIA agents, maybe, because that actually sounds to me like you've got more skills than an actor in a way. But actually, a lot of them would make quite good actors, I guess.
You know, it's interesting. There's a big big overlap between former intelligence, former CIA, and the entertainment industry. Some go on to be actors, but, you know, others go on to be writers. They go on to be fiction writers. They go on to become screenwriters. They go on to become advisors on spy films or action films or military films. So, yeah, the thing that is never lacking from CIA is ego. Ego is a huge driver among all CIA officers, all elite intelligence services. And it sounds like that would be, you know, counterintuitive, because if you have an ego, how are you going to ever be satisfied being a low-level bureaucrat and, you know, thrown into the world where you can only ever drive a Nissan and you can't wear a shirt that costs more than $50, right?
Yes.
So the way that ego plays in is because that secret network that we were talking about, the reason you don't feel totally alone, all that secret network does is it acts as an echo chamber where it keeps telling itself how special and how important and how valuable everyone in that secret network is. So 10, 15, 20 years of a career in that world, and all of a sudden you think like, I'm the most important person in the universe. The whole world needs me. The world needs me, and they don't even know I exist. That's how important I am, right? It becomes a very unhealthy echo chamber if you're not careful.
Does that mean there's a certain time frame career-wise for people in this kind of role that actually you can only be there a certain time before it actually really does start to sort of play with your mind?
Yeah, you know, so I would say once you're there for 3 or 4 years, you're really kind of drinking the Kool-Aid. Once you're there, we call it, so basically we measure our time in tours. So a tour is generally speaking somewhere between 2 and 4 years. So if you're a first tour officer, you've been in the CIA for less than 4 years. If you're a second tour officer, you've been in the CIA for less than 8 years, right? It's basically how we measure our time. And for the most part, first and second tour officers are seen as junior officers. If you've been in for two tours, you're still pretty junior, which means when they talk about junior, what they're talking about is there's certain responsibilities, certain decisions that you're not really included in, because you might still make the idealistic choice. You might still make like the non-practical choice. You might still believe that you're there to serve, you know, the higher cause of justice and freedom across America, instead of realizing that you're actually there to steal secrets and give those secrets to the White House. Like, let's be very focused about what you are if you're going to become a third or fourth tour officer. So it's in that third and fourth tour, somewhere between 8 and 15 years, that's where we all go through that very difficult growth phase where we realize we are just disposable resources, that if we get shot tomorrow, there's 500 people that are lined up ready to come in and be the next round of people who have a humongous ego and feel like they're the best gift to their country. So we start to realize we're disposable resources in terms of our life and our biology. But we're also disposable resources in terms of our knowledge and our skill set. You know, China's interesting now. It wasn't interesting 15 years ago. Russia's interesting now. It wasn't interesting 5 years ago. So you build an entire career specializing in some topic, and then whatever the administration chooses is what is the flavor of the day. So imagine being 20, 25 years into your career. You're the, you know, the foremost expert on Mozambique, and then nobody cares about Mozambique. And now in your sunset, you know, the sunset of your career, you're basically forgotten, even by that internal community that you've come to rely on. So there's always this this piece that shows you how you aren't as important as you think you are. And if you stay on past that fourth tour, if you make it four or five tours into CIA, now you've basically got nowhere else to turn. What are your marketable skills? What is your network? You don't have any place else to go. So now you kind of are stuck on the path of getting that government retirement and then trying to make whatever you can out of your reputation after you leave.
I'm just thinking, obviously, you talked about the large egos that are involved in the work. And how big an impact that must have on those people having to go through that scenario that you've just spelled out with regards to, like, you're kind of washed up, you're worthless almost to a certain extent, and how bruising that must be for some of those egos.
Yeah, it's very real. It's very true. And the ego bruising starts quite a bit earlier. It's just that, you know, as you get older, bruises take longer to heal, right? I remember being 11 or 15, and I would get a bruise on my shin, and 3 days later, it'd be gone. And now at 42, I get a bruise on my arm, and it's still with me for two more weeks. So, yeah, right? So when you are that retired 60-something-year-old security professional, and you really have done amazing things that the world doesn't know about, and then when you retire, you know, you don't get a Rolex. You don't get a big, fat paycheck. You don't get a high five. You don't even get, like, a medal of service. You kind of get a nice government dinner catered by a government caterer and they send you home. And then, you know, assuming that you are comfortable living off of your 60% retirement, you know, because you're going to be making 60% of your base pay. That's how the government retirement system works in the US. Once you start trying to go for a job, you think that you qualify for a senior executive position in a corporate 100 company, right? But you don't. You don't really qualify for anything except a high-level position in the intelligence world. Anywhere else you try to go, you essentially have to start all over again.
Man, that's really mad. And I'm just wondering, as you're talking there, like, is there, like, aftercare? Is there, like, CIA aftercare? Because I'm guessing those people that you're talking about going home, they're just sort of, like, sitting with their secrets that they can't tell anyone. So they must need some sort of therapy or counseling or something like that to kind of work through those years of service.
Yeah, so you know, it's funny, aftercare, just this is a one of those funny UK American things. In the US, aftercare is what you give to old people who are going insane. You give them aftercare.
Okay. Yeah, not quite what I was trying to get to.
In the United States, what we call, what you're referencing, is something that we call a transition, government transition, okay, or right, military transition. Which, for all I know, transition is the UK word for dealing with insane people. I don't know.
Actually, do you know what? It could be.
but yeah, so the military has done a really good job, because remember, we've got to always take the context of history here as well as part of our calculation. The military has, for a long time, the U.S. military and all militaries have had to deal with people who sign up and then they leave mid-career. They sign up and they leave. They sign up and they leave. So there's this requirement for transition so that, you know, military members who have seen trauma, lived through trauma, who have been given military secrets, whether that's, you know, how a tank works or what kind of munition works best against whatever, you know, those people need to go through some kind of transition training so that they can rejoin civilian life in a healthy, manageable way. CIA, in comparison, CIA has, until 2001, was always a very small organization where basically they had less than 0.5% attrition. And that 0.5% was essentially people who were retiring. And when they would retire, they would come right back in the next day as a government contractor. So they would spend their entire adult and their, like, until they basically fell into a casket, they would come back to work at the same building they had always worked at. So that was the tradition before 9/11. And then once 9/11 hit, that's when that tradition started to change. So post 9/11, that's when CIA started discovering that transition was even a problem. That attrition could exceed 2%, 3%, 5%. Right now, CIA's attrition rate is it's at a record high. There are numbers that come out that say that they're losing as many as one undercover officer every single day, wow, leaving service.
Oh, wow.
So 6 months to train an undercover officer, one or two tours in the field, and then they leave. That's something that the agency has never dealt with, and that's a very difficult challenge for a public organization to very quickly adapt. But that's, I think, to your point, Jim, there is no transition support. There's no aftercare support because it's never been a problem to them before. When you look at the history of espionage cases in the United States in the last 10 years, there's been a very distinct spike in new espionage cases from China, from Russia, from France, from all over the world. Anybody who's an enemy or even an ally of the United States are spying on the United States. And they know that, you know, CIA, NSA, DIA, FBI are all struggling with these mandates for higher recruiting, but also dealing with a younger generation that doesn't really like to be told what to do in the government way.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about secrets and keeping secrets and the advantage of keeping secrets. And I wonder also if it's harder to keep secrets in the 21st century than it possibly was to some of your CIA ancestors. Would that be a fair assumption, that it's harder to keep secrets now?
Yeah, I would say that. So the intelligence professional in me kind of wants to dig into this question a lot, because this is such a fascinating question. So I would say the idea that keeping secrets is an advantage is kind of a flawed idea. What's really the advantage is the perception that you can keep secrets. When you actually know how to use secrets, that's the bigger advantage. If you tell me something about Jim and Jim thinks that there's nothing that you told me and you believe that I'm keeping it a secret, but I'm actually telling somebody else and using that secret to gain some other advantage, that's the real advantage to a secret. You think I'm keeping the secret, which means you're going to give me more secrets. Jim doesn't even know it's happening, and I'm getting some third party on the outside who's not even connected to either of you to give me something else in exchange for that secret, right? That's what makes secrets so valuable, is when people sell them, barter them, trade them, use them, but nobody knows that it's happening. Mm. Now, to that same question, is it easier or harder to keep a secret? It's easy to say that it's hard to keep a secret because of the digital era that we live in. Everything's interconnected. You know, if you've got your phone in your pocket, somebody knows where you are. You can't even keep it a secret, you know, what you're searching for. You can use a incognito window or a VPN. There's still a data trail that tells everybody or tells somebody somewhere what you're doing. So I would say that to the extent that you can be discoverable, yes, it's harder to keep a secret. However, part of secrets is also keeping them from being discovered, not just being discoverable, but actually being found. And there has never been an easier time in the world to hide in plain sight, to bury a secret under a pile of noise, right? Your proverbial needle in a haystack. Mm-hmm. So now, yes, we might know exactly where Jim is sitting in a restaurant when he eats his dinner tonight, but he's hidden among hundreds of billions of people who are sending hundreds of billions of signals about where they're also sitting right now at dinner. So it's going to take a great deal of effort to try to uncover that secret about Jim.
That is fascinating. Although I will say, firstly, as a stand-up comedian, I tell all my secrets on stage. So there's no secret you can get from Giles about me. That's literally my job, just to tell everyone, even if they don't want to hear it, you're going to hear my secrets, mate. So that's just, yeah. That's interesting, because I would have thought that, like, messages can be intercepted now, and people can be, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, you can get people's information off each other and stuff. Whereas back in the day, like, if you had a briefcase with a really good lock on it, then that was a better way. But it's interesting to say about the noise. And we talk on this podcast quite a lot about, like, the sort of digital noise and how it's hard sometimes to find meaning in it or find any sort of useful information. But actually, on the flip side, I never really thought that noise could be useful to someone trying to hide something, because there is so much of it out there.
And that's the difference between, you know, amateur espionage and professional espionage. And when I talk about amateur espionage, I'm talking about what we watch a lot of times in spy fiction is amateurized. So, you know, you think that if two people walk into a room and you want to hide one of those people, then what you need to do is put a wig on them and put a fake face on them and make them look like they gained 50 extra pounds and then, you know, put this nondescript hat on them and let them just walk right through. And then if these two men walk down the hallway, no one's going to notice that one guy. Where a professional says, if you want to hide someone, then of the two people who walk in, all you have to do is make the other guy yell fire. And if the other guy yells fire, everyone in the building is going to look at the other guy. And it doesn't matter if you're, you know, dressed up like a drag queen. Nobody's going to remember you because you're hiding in plain sight, right? It's all about the distraction. It's all about taking advantage of a human's natural inclinations towards change, survival, fear. If you can trigger natural human responses, then that's more valuable than the most expensive disguise.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I got a really quick question about, because you were saying before about a lot of ex-CIA people might go into the arts or creative, Hollywood, that kind of thing, writing and stuff. Does that mean that the movies we watch, the spy movies, are true? I guess depending on who's worked on it, are they true to form? Are they not? Are they intentionally amateurized? Or are there some? Are there any you can think of where you think, fuck, that's actually really, really close to what it was?
So there are some that are really quite close. But those that get really close are close because that was the director's intent, right? So Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is very close. The first season of The Americans is actually quite close. There's these really good examples of tradecraft and some really good examples of how the bureaucracy works. The first season of, I think it was not Jack Reacher. I forget the name now. The gent that was in The Office who went on to make a spy series on Amazon.
John Krasinski.
Yes. Whatever his show was, the first season of that show was also really quite good because it was pretty accurate. And to the director's credit, they bring in advisors who give them advice, and then the director follows the advice. But then if you look at a show like Gray Man, right? I know the gentleman who was the advisor for Gray Man. And basically everything he suggested, the director's just like, they overruled it. They're like, we can't make a movie about that. The guy can't do that. Like, wait, you're telling me that in the street right now, he would just walk down the street with his head down? No, that's not going to work for us. So we're going to do this instead. And then we're going to do that. And you just tell us, if he was going to carry a gun, what kind of gun would he carry? Oh, no, he would never carry a gun. No. I get that. But if he was, what would that gun be? So then that's the big, you know, that's the inside joke that we have with each other when we get called into entertainment, is it's just like, you know, why we're not advising anybody. They're literally letting us give our advice so they can ignore it. And then they make up a scenario and they want our thoughts on that made up scenario. I was like, you'd be better off just getting a creative teenager to come in and give you that data. You'd pay them a fifth as much.
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to being out in the field and actually, I mean, you talked about disguises there kind of jokingly, but I guess you are having to wear disguises. Are there levels of disguises? Are there different scenarios that you have to put yourself into when you're actually out in the field? And there's one other caveat to that is also when you're out in the field, you must get into some quite intense moments. And how do you, you know, how are you able to sort of control yourself in those moments? And I guess that's part of your skills as an agent.
Yeah, and it's great. These are two great questions. They're not as related as I think we would hope they would be. But because oftentimes a disguise is to keep the heat away. Mm-hmm. And then if you're in a disguise and the heat happens anyways, there's not a lot of graceful solutions to how to get out of that one. But I will say that a big part of why my company, Everyday Spy, has taken off, and I've been very blessed to have a successful company, is because people have these questions and they realize how you can apply the answers to business. You can apply the answers to everyday life, to building your career or gaining an unfair advantage in the workplace. Now, on the disguise side, disguise is just fun. There's a ton of fun parts about disguise. There's three levels to disguise. There's a level one, level two, and level three. And this is, you know, largely boiled down. A disguise professional, which we call a costume professional, but a disguise professional at CIA would cringe what this oversimplification, but basically you have the kind of disguise that you can just don at any moment in time, a hat, a jacket, sunglasses, whatever it might be. That's all level one. It's sometimes called throwaway disguise or disposable disguise. The second level of disguise, level two, has to do with long-term disguise. This is a disguise where you're going to be undercover for 6 months, 9 months, 2 years. You don't know if someone's going to come into your room in the middle of the night. You don't know if someone's going to basically strip search you when you try to go through an airport. So when you have that kind of disguise, you can't wear a fake nose. You can't put in a fake tooth. You have to be very, very real. So if that means you very realistically gain 15 pounds, then you go gain 15 pounds. Or if you have to get super fit, then you'll spend 6 months getting into fantastic shape. Shave your head, get a tattoo, you know, whatever. Go through dental or oral surgery if you need to get a fake tooth put in or a couple tooth pulled out. Whatever you're doing, it's very, very real in level two. And then in level three, that's your prosthetics. That's your disguises where you have custom-made foreheads and custom-made cheekbones and fake blacked-out teeth and you change the color of your hair. But at the end of the day, all the fake comes off and the real person lays down in their bed to go to sleep at night. So it's that third level that makes it into the movies, but that third level is actually the most dangerous, the highest risk, and the least pay, like the least valuable of all the disguise levels. Because if you arrest somebody in level two, they'll never look like they're in a disguise. If you arrest somebody in level one, you take off their sunglasses, you take off their hat, they still aren't in a disguise. But if you arrest somebody in level three, you rip off their nose, you pull off their fake mustache, and now you're like, you're a spy, and you're going to jail for the rest of your life. Not in your own country, in the foreign country where you were captured. So that stuff is nasty. We don't want that to happen. So that's why our disguise and costume professionals prepare us for level one and level two in almost all situations. To go to your second question about, you know, how do you deal with some intense situations? The single most important factor when things get nasty is dealing with the traumatic spike in your emotions. So PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is all caused by a chemical overload of the amygdala in the brain. And the amygdala is, everyone has one, and it's basically accustomed to taking a certain amount of stress at any given time. But whenever that amygdala experiences more stress than it can handle, it basically short circuits. And unlike the circuits in your house, you can't take out the amygdala and put a new one in. So once it short circuits, it's short circuited forever. So CI is very focused on making sure that we constantly increase the load capacity for our amygdala. They do that by increasing the amount of stress that we're exposed to throughout training, so that anytime we experience something in the field, that's not the first time we've seen it. So we see what it's like to be hunted. We see what it's like to be captured. We see what it's like to be interrogated. We see what it's like to be, you know, stressed out in training environments multiple times, so that, and we try to, they try to give it to us at such a high level that it's more extreme than we'd ever see in the field. And then on top of that, they give us stress coping mechanisms. So if we do find ourselves under stress in the field, we can use science-backed coping mechanisms. I'm not talking about like kumbaya meditation, where's my banjo kind of stuff. I mean like, you know, breathing techniques and, you know, different physical exercises, mindfulness exercises that are backed in science that they know can rapidly reduce stress in a very short period of time. And some of those techniques have gone on. I've been able to teach those to police officers and teachers and corporate executives because they also live in a world where they know what it's like to have extreme spikes in stress. And they, if you've had so much stress that you actually feel your physiology changing, your eyes start twitching or your cheeks start twitching, you know what it's like to reach the tip of your amygdala's capacity. And it starts to short circuit the way your body normally works. So you start losing control of bodily functions, and it's extremely unnerving. So it's comforting to them to know that they can preserve their amygdala with a few simple exercises.
Yeah, that's great. And it's nice to know those skills are transferable as well to people in other areas. And as you say, to help with high levels of stress. It must be hard trying to replicate that in training. You know, again, there's a long running joke, Andrew, on the podcast. I try and get football into every episode. I'm about to do it again now. So But like, you know, footballers always say like, well, we train and train and train, but it's very different to playing a game, you know, very different to playing in front of 60,000 people, like that is a different pressure you can't replicate in training. And it must be kind of similar maybe to CIA training. You're training for these stressful situations, but actually in the situation when you're there at work, it must be difficult to replicate that. It's still a different feeling, different level of stress, no matter how much you train for that situation.
Yeah, it's true. And I would say it's actually the opposite of what your footballers are telling you. So when we train, we're almost always being observed. And you're being observed by this panel of people who have no interest in being nice to you. Like, they're the most critical panel you can imagine. So every mistake you make in training is hyper-criticized. And, you know, you never walk away from... Nobody goes to train... I remember in the corporate America, when I was in the corporate world after I left CIA, training was always a joke. People were like, oh, it's a training day. This is going to be easy. I'm going to stay up late drinking the night before. I'm not really going to pay attention. It's basically a day off. At CIA, when you had to go to training, people were like, oh my gosh, this is going to be miserable. I need to sleep in two nights before. I need to get myself clean. I need to get ready for this because it's going to be like just devastating, right? So for us in the field, nobody's watching. In the field, if you screw up, basically nobody knows that you screwed up. So unless you get caught, unless you screw up so much that you end up in prison, even in prison, nobody's judging you. They're just beating you. And, so, and to certain extents, like, that may not be as bad. But but if you make a mistake, if you fumble with the wrong word, or if you don't, you know, if you make a pitch and they don't accept the pitch, or if you forget a detail from a secret that they give you, nobody knows. And you just, you do the best you can. And you come back and you admit to your own errors. And you're like, hey, they gave me so much more than this. But, you know, I don't have the technical jargon to understand half of what they're talking about. So I'm going to have another meeting in two or three more weeks. And I'm going to try and bring an undercover engineer with me. And hopefully that person will help me do a better job, help me get more information out of the person. So it's a much more forgiving experience in the field than it is in training, which is quite different than your footballer example.
Yeah, very, very different. And when would anyone trust a footballer? Literally never. But that's really interesting, because in my head, and again, these are probably sort of very basic questions for your experience, but like in my head, like when agents are out in the field, they are being monitored by someone. Someone somewhere in a van is monitoring them or something. But actually, from what you're saying, they really are sort of on their own.
Because if you've done everything else right, nobody even knows you're there, right? Wow. If I've done everything right, when I get onto a plane in the United States, no matter where I get off the plane, nobody even knows that I am what I truly am. They just see a passport number and a name on the passport, and I cross a border somewhere and somebody gives me a stamp, because the person who gives me a stamp is thinking about getting off work. They're not thinking about looking for spies. And then I go do my thing all day long, collect my secrets, do whatever I'm doing. I get back on, I cross another border, I get another stamp, because that person again is just thinking about, you know, the indigestion from lunch. And then I'm on a plane and I come back to the United States. If you do everything right, if everything works, nobody even knows you were there. It's only when you are not a professional that you end up having an action movie.
But that's when nobody wants that. But that's mad though, because from what you're saying, like the training is so good at the CIA that they don't even know where you are, and they're kind of like sending you out being like, well, I hope Andrew comes back. I hope he doesn't just run off somewhere and go and join somebody else. Like, there must be a level of trust there. They're like, well, we've trained him to a level we think he's so good, we hope he's gonna come back. But like, you're just out there.
Yeah, we have these what we call comma windows, communication windows. So it's essentially a sign of life, but it's also a chance to give a status update. And those comma windows are usually about 24 hours. Sometimes they go as long as 72 hours or more, but for the most part, it's about 24 hours. So, you know, I'm going to high five you or Giles first thing in the morning. I'm going to be, hey, I'm out. I'll see you guys later. I'm going to Kuala Lumpur. And then you won't hear from me for like 24 hours later. I'll send you a quick three paragraph update. Hey, plane ride was safe. Nothing interesting. Made it to the hotel. Here's my room number in case, you know, you ever need it in the future, if you need to evacuate me or something. But I'm good to go, ready for tomorrow, the end. And then 24 hours later or 48 hours later, met the guy, got the secrets, everything's good. You know, I'm writing a detailed report. I'll send it in encrypted channels circa 6 a.m. tomorrow Eastern time, right? And then you don't hear from me again until you get the encrypted report. And, you know, 4 or 5 days, because every time there's communication, you're introducing an opportunity for vulnerability. Mm. So you want to minimize communication. The way you do that is by maximizing training and maximizing trust.
Yeah.
Are you able to talk about any of the missions you've done and stuff? Or is that one of the things that you can't talk about post leaving?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So the one area that we're not allowed to disclose when we leave without express permission is our own specific operational background. So I can paint in broad strokes. I specialized in Asia and East Asia. You can tell that from the language that I learned when I was in the military. My travel profile, whether you look at my travel profile undercover or overtly, I've got a lot of experience in East Asia and Southeast Asia. So, and I'm a brown guy. A brown guy does very well in Asia because Asia is the most racist continent in the world. They don't ever think a brown guy is dangerous. So it was just a really good fit for me to go have fun, you know, in the land of the rising sun and such, where nobody really took me seriously. It was a perfect place to blend in.
That's sort of playing on sort of cultural perceptions as well to your advantage.
Yep, exactly right. If you were to send a white person to the UK, if you were to send a white 45-year-old male with disheveled brown hair and who hadn't shaved his morning beard, he'd basically be able to walk through the UK without anybody noticing.
Oh, wait, that's me. Wait, am I a spy? Hang
on. That's how good you are.
Yeah.
That explains a lot. That explains why I feel so lonely. Okay. Oh, man. No, I only asked. I assumed that was the question. Absolutely assumed that was the answer, and that would be one of the stipulations. But are you able to talk to us in broad strokes about any situations where, you know, you really felt, I don't know, maybe the window had been 72 hours and you really felt alone and you were in situations where you really had to put kind of some of that stress level training into practice, and maybe where you really felt things were a bit dicey and how you came through that. And I'll say that with the caveat that, you know, this podcast is about blank moments and we don't normally have anyone with high stakes blank moments like this. You know, it's normally performers talking about going blank on stage, but I'm just wondering if you've ever had anything like that where you really have had to sort of kick in the training in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been several moments like that in life, but let me give you one that's probably the most powerful for me. And then to be very transparent, I also I have to jump after this story most likely to move on to my next commitment.
No worries.
But I was on operation. I was in a part of Asia that I can't disclose as of this time. I've got permission out with CIA asking them to allow me to disclose the larger story. But I was fairly certain that I had been discovered. I was fairly certain that from the surveillance that I discovered following me to the scenarios that were presented to me, I was almost certain that I had become not just a person of like a suspicious person, but a suspected intelligence operative operating in a foreign country. So it was an extremely scary moment for me, and it was completely and totally unexpected. In all of the security briefings and all of the mission planning and all of the prep work that we had done before I deployed, we had all come back with very high confidence that it would be a fairly successful mission. It's a mission that we had repeated several times beforehand, that I had repeated several times beforehand, and there was no history of any kind of mistake or overlap. So in that moment, when I was able to confirm a surveillance team was in fact following me and that surveillance team was a well-equipped, advanced, sophisticated surveillance unit, it was a kind of an oh shit moment where I felt every ounce of the loneliness. I felt every piece of the fear. I had the thought of not seeing my wife again. I had the thought of, you know, not seeing the life that I was trying to build. I was trying to have a family. I was trying to have children. I was trying to, you know, make something memorable. And in this blank, to use your term, in this blank space, you know, when you take everything else away, the things that fill up emptiness are the things that are overflowing, right? It's like a vacuum. And the things that came in were just, I realized how much I loved my spouse. I realized how much I loved, you know, Chinese food and being able to swim in water that's room temperature in Florida and all these silly little things that I take for granted all the time. And then I also realized that the longer I let myself dwell in that moment, the more at risk I was of never seeing those things that I cared about. So I don't know how long that period lasted, that kind of realization, But whether it was microseconds or seconds, you know, they ticked across in very real heartbeats. And then we had to, and then I was thankfully trained well enough that I fell into that training regime. And it was a matter of breathing techniques, and it was a matter of advanced counter surveillance techniques. And it was a matter of using time to my advantage and anticipating human behavior and realizing that, to a certain extent, we always have to realize that we know we are spies. We know it every minute of every day. But to everyone else, if they suspect that we are spies, there's still a shadow of a doubt. So you have to gamble hard on that shadow of a doubt, because so people will refrain from taking the right action when they have the shadow of doubt. So that was essentially what I had to do to get out of that moment was just play on what I knew would be the entire surveillance team's human intention or human behavior is going to be to wait, to observe, to react. So yeah. I always have first mover advantage. So when I took those actions, I was able to get myself to a place where I was able to get off the X. It was dicey at the end, but it still worked. And once I was on a plane and the rear tires took off the ground, that's when I finally took my collective sigh and realized that I was gonna give my wife a big hug and never go back to that country again.
Oh my word, man! Well, thanks for sharing that. Yeah, thank you. It probably wasn't easy to go back to that kind of place, so I really, really appreciate that. But before you jump off, do you want to just tell us about Everyday Spy and the work you do now?
Yeah, absolutely. So my company is called Everyday Spy. You can find it at everydayspy.com. I host a very popular iTunes Top 1% podcast called the Everyday Espionage Podcast. And everything about my company, everything about my podcast, everything about my business is teaching real world spy skills, spy tactics, spy strategies, and how they apply to everyday life, business life, personal life, relationships, fitness, health, wellness, whatever it might be. And I'm blessed to have an amazing following. I'm blessed to have an awesome customer base. We serve individuals and we serve corporations. We've really seen some fantastic growth. And like so many people out there, I don't think we ever anticipated it. We started the business to try to do something that we cared about and teach people about espionage because we love, my wife is former CIA also. But we both just love that life and we love that world. And we want to continue to bring honor to the people who do that work. So if you find us at everydayspy.com or on social media at everydayspy, then we'd love to hear from you and we'd love to serve you.
Fantastic.
It's fantastic work and best of luck with the future. And yeah, thanks for joining us. Could have chatted to you for hours.
Yeah, thank you so much. I've written so many notes. This is the most notes I've ever written for a podcast. So thank you so much.
My pleasure, gents. And thank you very much for the kind invite and for a chance to talk to a couple of boring UK chats.
Yeah.
Perfect. There you go. Andrew Bustamante on the Blank Podcast. Or was he on the Blank Podcast? No, he was. He was. And he's an ex-spy. Or is he actually an ex-spy?
Well, there's one question I was going to ask was, do you ever stop being... in some respects, you've got those skills instinctively in you, haven't you? So do you ever stop looking over your shoulder, having conversations in a certain way?
Maybe
reading
not.
Reading body language.
I guess you're not working for anyone, so you're not having to collect information, but maybe you do still use those skills. Mm. Yeah, well, that is something you would find out if you were...
He could have been profiling us while we were talking to him.
I think he'd very quickly decide, nah, these guys aren't worth it. Everyday Spy is Andrew's company, so if you want to find out more, that's the place to go and check him out. And as you said, he's happy to work with anybody. So do check him out. There'll be a link in the description below as well to check him out. But fascinating guy. I mean, just, you know, really a really good chatter as well, really good talker, so able to really sort of like describe some of those moments and those feelings and stuff.
Super smart guy, very erudite, so it was great to have him on, and really appreciate him giving us his time because he's a busy
guy. And you know, one of these different episodes for us, and we've got a few more lined up over the next few weeks and months. So if you've enjoyed this, please get in contact because we need to hear from people. But if you have and you like these sort of like different themed episodes, then please do let us know. Maybe you've got someone in mind or a theme in mind for future guests and episodes. Let us know and we'll try and make it happen because we want to, you know, make stuff that people obviously want to listen to. So get in contact with us at Blank Pod on pretty much any platform. And let us know and we'll try and make it happen. But it's been, I found it absolutely fascinating. And it's been absolutely lovely having Andrew on the show.
Yeah. And yeah, like Jim says, if you want to get in contact with us, you can. We're on all social media platforms apart from TikTok and Snapchat because that's for kids.
So well, you say that. Yeah.
And Jim. But yeah, the other ones, the more important ones we're on. And yeah, we are at Blank Pod. So please do get in contact with us. And yeah, it'd be lovely to hear from you. And we'll see you again next week. Well, we won't see you, but you'll hear us.
You'll hear from us. that sounds like a spy, actually. It's exactly what CIA would say, I guess. You'll hear from us.
You won't see us, but you'll
in 24 hours time. Exactly. See you in 24 hours. Yeah. Actually, it'll be 24 times 7.
Yeah, it'll be quite a long. We'll be off the grid for quite a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. So take care of yourselves.
They'll be sending another agent in to try and find us.
We'll be replaced.
We've gone rogue.
Yeah. Gone rogue. They've gone rogue. That's what they always say about Jim and Giles. It's the most rogue podcast out there. Rogue. It's very.
We haven't heard from them for at least 128 hours.
That's good maths. Anyway, have a great week, everyone, and we'll see you again next week. Goodbye.
Media Podcast.